Once again, we had some technical issues here because the PC here in this AG Delta is not working properly. So sorry about that. But based on these my latest experiences, this was the third time that the things are not working okay. So probably we will switch to completely online working from next week onwards until the end of the whole course. The other reason is that I have only two students here, so this is very private occasion here at the moment, but nevertheless, this is now working okay. Okay, so welcome to this sixth lecture on principles of banking. And the theme in this lecture is now about conducting monetary policy action. So I suppose that all of you took a look at these slides from 1 to 59 in the second part of the lecture notes, because that is just a general description of the central bank system. So you should be now aware of those. Some of you have already asked about the actual actions of the ECB, for example, and the Federal Reserve during the unconventional monetary policy period. I will give you very good, very recent articles on those things, so you can take a look at those in the setting of articles for the home assignments. So one of the themes will actually be this, how are we able to get rid of unconventional monetary policy situation based on the most recent research. Okay, so basically you should be now familiar with the structure and working and administration of the most important central banks in the global central banking system. So we should be now able to go to the actual theoretical modeling of how do these central bank actions or monetary policy actions, how are they transmitted to the actual real economic performance. So for that purpose, it's obviously important for you to understand how does the money supply process work. Who makes the decisions at which point of time, and how can you model those things in terms of the changes in the items in the asset side and liability side of each and every agent. The banks, individual banks, and the central bank that are the banking sector firms. Central bank is not a firm, it's a government institution, but nevertheless, it also has a balance sheet. And the extension of the central bank's balance sheets, the most recent extensions, are being recorded based on the unconventional monetary policy actions. So it's about extending the monetary policy, the central bank balance sheet through the extension of its asset side. Okay, so let's start from this. This should be the slide number 60. Start the discussion about the money supply process. So you have first to understand the, I'm just admitting people here. Okay. So you should first understand the role of the different actors in this general system. So we have three different sectors basically here. The central bank is the one that has the only mandate to issue money by the law. It's the only institution that is able to print money, coins and notes. And money, which means the most liquid form of assets, is the one that is being used either in an electronic form or in plain cash for your consumption purposes. So the depositors, individuals and institutions, firms and other agents, other than these banks and central bank, make the deposits to to the banks. So we want to analyze the interconnections between these three sectors in the economy. And banks in general are the ones that are performing now the function of indirect transmission of funds from the sectors that are in excess of supply of funds for those that are in demand for the funding. Okay, so that basic idea of direct channel of financing and indirect channel of financing should be remembered also here. So let's start this analysis. Let's start from the main components of the central bank's balance sheet. All the securities that the central banks hold are recorded as assets, and all the loans to the financial institutions are recorded as assets. Those are the main components. For example, the buildings do not nowadays play such a huge role, even though, for example, the headquarters of ECB is very huge building in Frankfurt. It has a lot of value, but that's not the main thing at all. Then you should understand also that at the liability side, the main thing that the central bank is in charge of at each and every point of time is the currency in circulation, because it has the single authority. It is the single authority that has been given the permission to print money. So it's in charge of all the money that is in the circulation in the system. And then the reserves in the overall banking system are also in the liability side of the central bank. So the bank deposits at central bank and the world cash are also reserves for the central bank. They are liabilities. So obviously, if you consider as the first counterparty for the central bank, the individual banks, the interbank market, so where do you record the reserves in the bank side? If they are liabilities for the central bank, what should they be for the individual bank? The other side. So remember, this is the main idea. You just always have to remember that if something changes on the liability side of some of the agents, then something has to change also on the asset side at the counterparty's balance. That's the main asset. This is very simple chain of events, actually. But when we get to, when you understand that there are thousands of actors in here, so it, obviously nowadays it requires an electronic system of transfers to be working. You cannot use just cash for these purposes. It would be too costly to do anything. Then another important understanding here is that for the part of asset side, government securities play a big role in central banks' assets. They have always played a big role. By the law, central banks cannot buy directly the government assets from the governments, even now, even though they have been heavily buying those assets. But they are buying those from the secondary markets, not from the primary issues or the original issues, but from the secondary markets, from the banking sector. And this is actually nowadays plays the biggest role in the unconventional monetary policy actions. Central banks have promised to buy everything that the banks want to sell in the form of government securities. So basically they are now financing actually government, because they are keeping the secondary market for government bonds alive all the time. They are always prepared to be a buyer for those assets. Do you understand this? Do you have a question? You look like Ellie. Basically, yeah, but not officially. Central bank should be an independent institution by the law from the government. There are lots of discussions going on all the time, whether they still are. They are basically by the law still independent. Like in the previous slides, there were lots of discussion about the independence of the central banks. At the origins, when they were founded, they were thought to be independent of the policy actions or the government public policies, not engaged too much into the financing of the public sector. So you could be able to make a clear distinction between monetary policy actions and fiscal policy actions. Taxation and public expenses are completely different from the monetary policy actions. But nowadays, these are getting mixed, actually, because the central banks are keeping the secondary markets for the government bonds and government assets very much aligned. They have clearly announced that they are willing to buy everything that the banks are willing to sell in terms of getting more liquidity. The main idea is here still about the term structure of interest rates. So basically, central banks are operating at the longer end of the maturity structure to enable the banking sector to get more funding at the shorter end. So at the cheaper part of the term structure price. So the government securities are nowadays playing a huge role. And the reason for that is actually that, for example, the discount loans are not anymore playing such a huge role in the markets, because the interest rate is not an opportunity cost for banks anymore, because it's actually one form of profits nowadays, because it's negative in the European level, not in the Federal Reserve System, but in the European level. So it's not an opportunity cost for getting the funding from the central bank anymore. But nevertheless, the central banks are still there. One of the articles that I'm going to be giving to you is discussing about the role of these traditional forms of monetary policy actions. Do they still have a role to play even nowadays when we have used these extensive forms of other unconventional monetary policy? The clear answer already now is that not very much anymore. It's only limited, very limited. There's a nice paper in the Journal of Banking and Finance that is actually only forthcoming in the near future, but it is analyzing these things, really. I will give that as one of the home assignment papers for you. Okay, in terms of theoretical representations, it's about identities. So we are not introducing these relationships between the various measures, relevant measures in the banking or the liquidity markets for liquidity. We are not using those as any kind of regression models. These are identities. These should hold at each and every time, at least overnight terms. So during the first possible banking day, after the actions have taken place in the previous day, these identities should be holding immediately after that. So in economics terms, when we start the discussion about the monetary base, we use this high-powered money, which means that we define the monetary base, MB, to be equal to the currency in circulation and total reserves in the banking system. So what are these? What do these two guys constitute? In whose balance sheet are they playing the role? In the central bank's balance sheet. So they are the liabilities. So the whole monetary base is a liability for the central bank. It is completely in charge of that. When it wants to have an effect on the banking system, it will have an effect on the high amount of high-powered money. That's the starting point. In normal times, I must stress all the time that we are discussing basically these models for the sake of having normal times at some time in the future, once again, after we have been able to get rid of this unconventional monetary policy situation, and we would be still once again analyzing all the things based on the positive rate of interests. So the discounting ideas would be working properly. Now they are not working. But nevertheless, so what does in actual terms take place in the balance sheets of these all these actors in the markets? If a central bank makes an open market purchase, which means that it's now operating in the interbank markets, in the secondary markets for all the assets that are available there. So if it makes a buy, it makes a purchase from the banking system, then in the banking system's balance sheet, the only things that happen is an asset transformation process. So it just has an effect on the form of assets. So banks get more, the most liquid form of funds, the reserves, plain money. So they can basically use those reserves to extend their loan portfolio. That's one of the original ideas for engaging into open market purchases by the central bank. So it's just a form of asset transformation. But for the central bank side, it concerns both sides of the balance sheet, because the increased amount of reserves in the asset side of banking system is an increased amount of reserves on the liability side of the central bank. And also its assets increase by the same amount, because it's buying the certificates of deposits of the banks from the banking sector. For example, Nordea has originally issued a certificate of deposit, and ECB or the Bank of Finland and other banks that are relevant for Nordic markets have denoted that they're willing to buy the Nordea certificate of deposit from the Danske Bank's balance sheet. That's the actual trade that takes place. So there are changes, nothing changes in the Nordea balance sheet, because it's just that it's a Nordea asset, but Danske Bank is holding that. So there comes a change in the Danske Bank's balance sheet in terms of the form of assets, and a change in the ECB's balance sheet for the same amount, but in both sides. So that is the main thing. All the main commercial banks are trading in these markets, and ECB is participating to those markets as the main market maker. So if there's no demand for Nordea assets, and for some reason or other, ECB wants to have the liquidity of the Nordea assets at the high level, then it will engage into buying Nordea assets. It will have a small effect on the overall level of the money market interest rates, not a big amount because it's only Nordea assets. But if the ECB is willing to buy all the banks, all the certificates of deposits of all the banks at the same time, then it will be having an effect on the interest rate that is at a larger scale. But an individual trade does not necessarily make too much, does not have a very big effect. So the main thing here is for you to understand there's no change in currency. Basically, only the form of securities changes in the banking sector, and there is a change in the both sides of the central bank. This is an open market operation. Obviously, if the bank wants to, so what is the effect of this purchase on the prices of that Nordea asset? It increases the price and lowers the interest rate on that, because they have a negative relationship. So if the central bank thinks that it is worthwhile to have an effect on the interest rate, a minor effect based on trading with the Nordea asset, then it will go and buy that asset from some banks. and it will have a lowering. So it's an expansionary monetary policy action. Expansion means that the interest rate that is relevant also for the real economic behavior goes down. It's an expansionary monetary policy action. And this is the standard way in normal times that the central bank basically does or executes the monetary policy. Nowadays, it has lost its significance. It's not so important anymore, but it still has a limited role. In the ECB system, the problem is that all the prices are now in a perverse way denoted based on a perverse market equilibrium because the interest rates are negative. So the discounting ideas are not playing at the moment like they should be playing. But nevertheless, it has an effect on the monetary base because the reserves have increased. Monetary base changes have to be taken into account through the changes in the liabilities of the central bank. When you discuss the monetary base, take always a look. Don't pay attention to the asset transformation in the banking system. It's not the relevant thing because the monetary base is the relevant thing. And it's on the liability side of the central bank. So take a look at that. That is the key thing. Okay, so if there comes a open market purchase from the non-bank sector, so what are the changes in that case? Some individual, let's say, government, for example. Government is not actually a relevant case, but let's say a large individual firm might be selling bonds to the central bank, and deposits the central bank's check that is basically the proxy for cash that it is getting from the trade in the bank, not in the central bank, but in the banking sector. Because individuals usually don't have accounts in the central bank. Nowadays, there have been some discussions about so-called helicopter money. Have you ever heard about that? The main idea in that is that basically each and every individual in the economies would have an account at the central bank. A central bank would be giving the money directly, not through the banking sector, but directly to the person. So it would be something like you can distribute from the helicopter to each and every one, and you just would get the notes and coins from the ground. That's the idea of helicopter. But it's not a thing that would basically have any kind of role in the loan extension process of the banking sector. It doesn't actually save banking sector at all if it were to be in troubles. It might have only a very short-term effect on consumption behavior of the other sectors in the economy. So it's not something that economists very much believe in. Central bank would have, obviously, might have it should be fairly, let's say, fair to each and every agent. So it should consider each and every as an equal one. And it's not the case in many cases because for individual countries, for example, certain firms might get much more liquidity from the central bank because they are seen as systemically important firms, for example. So the banking sector is the one that the central banks want to play with. But nevertheless, this will have an identical result as the purchase from a banking sector because the monetary base changes the same amount. So take a look always on the effects regarding the changes in the liability side of the central bank because that is the monetary base. Okay. If the person is selling the bonds, cashes the central bank check, then in this case, you actually have a situation that the reserves are unchanged and currency in circulation, if it wants to change that into plain cash. So the currency in circulation changes based on that idea. And it changes exactly the same amount as the open market purchases. So monetary base increases once again, but in other form. So here it increased in the form of reserves, but in this case, it increases in the form of currency. if the person changes that cash into plain currency or that deposit to the plain currency. So nevertheless, it's an expansionary. Always when the central bank makes a purchase, whether it is from the banking sector or from the other sectors in the economy, it's always an expansionary monetary policy action. So it should have a lowering effect on the interest rate. Idea of expansionary comes through the effects on the interest rate, and the interest rate is the relevant thing for the real economic sector. Purchasing purposes, consumption, investments, and international trade, for example. Okay, so in this case, as a summary, we can say that if there comes a open market purchase, so the initiator of this is usually the central bank. Individual banks can go also and ask whether the central bank would be willing to buy, but they have no reason basically to sell it, especially to the central bank, because it's going to be sold at the market price. The central bank is the final market maker. If no one else is willing to buy, and it's worthwhile to buy at that stage those assets, then the central bank will buy. So central banks are very active players all the time. For example, these activities take place in the Federal Reserve System. They take place in the New York Federal Reserve. Open Market Committee there decides about these general large-scale purchases and sellings. And at the ECB system, they take place at individual country-level central banks. So each and every central bank in the ECB system has its own trading rule for these assets. And one of the very nice and very interesting jobs for you, for example, to be working would be in working in this one of these trading groups in central banks, for example. There you get to be introduced to the functioning of the money markets in real life. It's very fast actions in some cases. It can be decisions about buying for the worth of hundreds of millions in 1 second, but you have to be aware of the effects of your purchase. These large-scale operations are usually dictated completely by the boards of governors in the federalist system, for example, and in the ECB committee. They will decide these large scale. But the central banks are always in smaller scale trades. They are always very active participants. They want to have the markets going on all the time. And in times of liquidity crisis, like we have been experiencing also during the corona crisis, central banks have to do large-scale actions within a very short time. So they are prepared. They have the systems ready, decision systems ready there to make very large-scale actions in a very short time. They start, once again, all these actions very short-term, from the short-term markets, and then extend towards the longer-term maturities, towards the government bond, government assets also. Okay, so as a summary, the effect of an open market purchase on reserve depends on whether the seller of the bonds keeps the proceeds from the sale in currency or in deposits. Nevertheless, it has an effect on the liabilities of the central bank. And the monetary base always increases by the amount of the purchase, exactly. So basically, central bank at the origin has an idea about the amount, how much is it willing to purchase by from the markets. It has a forecast about the effect or an idea about the effect of its purchase on the interest rate. How much would it have an effect on that? That's the primary reason. It wants to have an effect on the interest rate. Purchase lowers interest rate. It's an expansionary monetary policy action because it's a buying, so there's a very short-term excess demand for that asset. And you remember from the supply and demand analysis that immediately the variable that adapts to that is the price. It goes up and the interest rate comes down. So in general terms, it should be an expansionary thing to overall economy. And the sale. What about the sale? The main ideas are exactly the same here. The changes are just with an opposite sign in these cases. So it reduces the monetary base by the same amount as the sale is. Reserves might be unchanged, and it's a contractionary action because it increases the interest rate. So basically, you just have to understand the final effects on the interest rate. And it comes through the effects on the banking sector or the non-bank sector. And if there comes a shift from deposits into currency, then the net effect on monetary liabilities is obviously in the central bank side, it's different. It's zero. There's no change in the overall amount of liabilities. It's just a liability transformation for the central bank. And there are some changes in the reserves that appear actually based on random fluctuations. But in general terms, you can say that the monetary base is fairly relatively, it's stable variable because it's at the origin, it's mostly dictated by the behavior or decisions of the central bank. So stabilizing the inflation rate and the development of interest rates is very much in the interests of the central bank activities. So obviously, because having an effect on the monetary base have an effect on the interest rates and on the general inflation level, if they want to stabilize those things, then they should also stabilize the behavior of the monetary base. And in historical terms, it has been fairly stable variable up until the crisis of 2008. But after that, there have been huge changes, and it's nothing like a stable variable at the moment. And that is because of the unconventional monetary policy actions. So in historical terms, it has been. So we have to add here actually the word that in historical terms, monetary base has been fairly stable variable. So what about the chain of events in the case of loans to the financial institutions? So we are now talking about the central bank loans to the financial institutions. This is one form of using monetary policy actions by the central bank. So if it wants to give a loan to a financial institution, usually at the origin of the banking or interbank market behavior is the possibility of the individual banks to come to the so-called discount window to ask for the loans. Usually the starting point here is the idea from the individual bank that it's in need for funding, so it needs a loan. Central bank is basically not offering all the time loans to the banks. The demand comes from the banks, so they want to have the funding in the form of loan, and they prefer the funding from the central banks for some reason or other, not as a loan from other banks, for example, but preferably from the central bank. So in that case, the assets of the central bank, obviously, the loan that it gives to the to the individual bank is an asset for the central bank because it should be getting a positive interest rate from that in normal times. Nowadays, it's not getting because the reference rate is negative in the ECB area at the moment, but it's still a facility for the interbank sector. And actually, the individual banks in the banking sector are able to increase their net interest margin based on taking loans from the central bank because they are the negative rate of interest. But nevertheless, the amount of liabilities at the central bank's balance sheet also increases, because the increased loans increase also the reserves in the banking system. So the purpose of taking a loan from the central bank, of an individual bank, is to be able to expand its loan portfolio to the customers. It wants to give more loans to the customers. It wants to make more profits from the loans. It's able to charge a higher interest rate from the customer loans compared to the interest rate that is paying to the central bank from that fund. Yeah.
Why is it not more currency
circulation? It's in this case, it's based on the what comes first. It doesn't come in the form of currency to the banks. So it's not in the form of changes in the currency, it's in the form of changes in the reserves, because it's for the purposes of giving loans. The amount of currency can only increase after that. But basically, this is for the loan extension process, like I already mentioned, that it is for the purposes the individual bank wants to have a loan from central bank because it wants to give loans to the customers. So this is the first step in that process. So the monetary liabilities of the central bank increase by 100, and the monetary base also increases by this amount. But it's at this stage, it's only in the form of reserves to the banking system, not in the form of the currency at the moment. So basically, after that, it can give, we will start the discussion about the loan extension process also very soon. But in that case, it's the main thing here is that the bank is now asking a loan from the central bank for some purposes. It needs to have more funding. And in normal times, and also during these unconventional monetary policy times, central banks are always there, serving as the lender of last resort. No one else is willing to give a loan to that individual bank, and it is indeed need for funding. It wants to still have the business going on and issue loans to the customers. The central bank is performing as the lender of last resort. It will give the loan. The price might be different compared to some other banks that are performing better. The price might be different, so the interest rate charge on the central bank loan can be different because the individual bank seems not to be performing so well. So there's a higher default premium also for that central bank loan, actually. But nevertheless, it will give. So the next step in this process depends on the pricing activity or the pricing ability of the individual bank, how well it is able to price the loans that it will be giving to its customers at the higher interest rate. So is it able to make a profit from the difference between the loans that it's giving to the customers and for the funding and the funding that it's getting from the central bank? That is the main thing. Okay. So other factors that have effect on the monetary base. First of all, this so-called float, which means that it refers to the cash items that are in the process of collection of the of the funds. So basically, it's a kind of a duplicate money in the system for a short period of time, because it refers to the period of time between the deposit being made in the recipient's account and the money that's being deducted from the sender's account. So it's a settlement time difference, actually. The general definition for that is the float in the fund transmission system. Okay. And then the government deposits. Governments, even though central banks cannot buy directly the government's assets, the governments are able to make deposits to their central banks. So there is a clear connection, actually, between the government sector, let's say, excess surplus in the funding So it can make deposits to the central bank. And then obviously the monetary base is also affected based on the interventions in the foreign exchange market. If the central bank wants to engage into a valuation of its currency, but the same ideas go there also. When it is selling the currency, it will be lowering the price. So the change in the currency value will be increasing and vice versa in that case. And in earlier times, when the monetary policy actions actually involved also very heavy interventions in the foreign exchange markets, when we had this, for example, in Finland, when we had this independent monetary policy, independent central bank of the other banks, we had our own currency. So it was in our interests to have an effect on the value of the currency, because the lower the value of the currency in nominal terms is, the higher are the prospects for our export companies in terms of making profit. The same amount of selling with the higher price because of the value of the currency is lower. So before going into in or starting the European Monetary Union and also the common currency area, euro area, actually the Bank of Finland was very active in defending the value of the Finnish currency, the Finnish marka. It also had a huge effect on the interest rates, and we actually caused by ourselves a huge slump during the first beginning of 1990s due to this hard currency policy. So the interest rates were short-term interest rate at one point of time at the beginning of before our huge slump, before the floating of the Finnish marka were at the level of 16%, the short-term maturity. 3 months Helibor interest, Helsinki interbank offer rate was at the level of 16%, just before the floating of marka in October 1992. And that is actually something that, and the main reason was very active interventions in the foreign exchange market by the Bank of Finland, because it wanted to defend the value of our currency. So interest rates had to be increased at that time. You will be introduced also to these things in the international finance course in more details. Kari Heimonen will be discussing about these things there. So if we take an overview of the central bank's ability to control the monetary policy or the monetary base, open market operations are fully controlled by the central bank in each and every central bank. So, but it cannot determine the amount of borrowing by other banks, the banking sector, because that depends on their business activities, how much they do want to issue loans to their customers. So that depends more on the general real economic activity, demand for loans of the banking sector. But you can split the monetary base that is of interest to the central bank, because it has a complete, it's a complete dictator based on this idea of liabilities in its asset, in its balance sheet. So you can split the monetary base to the non-borrowed part. NBN refers to the non-borrowed part of the monetary base, and borrowed reserves refers to the amount of reserves that can be borrowed in the monetary base. So the money supply is positively related to both the non-borrowed monetary base, so together MB equals NBN plus BR. If you move this BR to the left-hand side, you get the monetary base, non-borrowed part of that, and the borrowed part of that, basically. The borrowed part of the monetary base is the one that enables the loan extension process through the banking sector towards the other sectors in the economy. Okay, but all this has to take place through the banking sector, and the requirements that the central bank sets, for example, for the required reserves regarding the amount of deposits that each and every bank has to have as a central bank deposit in the bank to meet the possible situation where the customers of the bank want to suddenly withdraw money from the deposit accounts, they have to have a certain amount of required reserves. It's very low nowadays. It's very much variable thing in the Federal Reserve System. For example, in the ECB system from 2012, it has been only 1% of deposits. So it's not a big thing nowadays. But let's go into digging deeper in that thing, actually. When we start to discuss about the multiple deposit creation process, we have a situation where we'll be discussing the interactions between the different banks in the banking sector and the role of central banks in that chain of events. Okay, so let's once again start this discussion from the situation that in this slide, basically there comes a open market purchase by the central bank. So let's start from the same situation as in the previous slides. There comes an expansionary monetary policy action. What does that indicate to the overall behavior of other banks or the banks in general in the funds intermediation process? So the purchase comes from this First National Bank. So basically it can be in the form of, so we are not recording now the changes in the central bank balance sheet here, but we are more interested about the changes in the banking sector balance sheet. So the amount of reserves increases through this central bank purchase, open market purchase. Securities decrease by the same amount because the individual bank, the First National, is selling the securities. So on the asset side, there's once again asset transformation. But it now has more reserves. So it can expand its loan portfolio. It can give loans to the customers of the bank. So at the First National Bank's balance sheet, actually, it can give loans to the customers and their customers' deposits increase in exactly the same amount as it's giving the loans. The originator of this expansion is the central bank. It has bought things from the National Bank, First National Bank's balance sheet, and hence the First National Bank is able to expand its businesses. And the expansion comes through issuing new loans. So the amount of deposits in the customers' deposit accounts increases also by the same amount. So bank loans out the excess reserves. Let's assume at this first stage that there's no, basically in this stage, there is no change in the deposits, but here actually there is now a change in the deposits. So it creates a checking account for the customers and puts the money there. And after that, the customers can use the money for their purposes. Bank is fairly interested about the uses of money, what are the purposes in terms of the surveillance of the customer behavior, but nevertheless, they can use it for their own purposes. So in general terms, the money supply in the overall economy, let's assume that there's only one bank. All the customers are customers of the one bank, First National. There is a money supply process that has started to increase the amount of money in the economy. So it now has the same amount of securities, but the amount of loans is 100. So let's now assume at the next step, when we realize that there is an increase in the deposits because the money is being given to the customers in the form of deposits. So by the law, central banks are requiring from the banking system that for the purposes of facing the possibility that at any time in the future, customers can come to the bank and withdraw their funds there from their deposit accounts. So that is the reason why these central banks issue or use these reserve requirement ratios. They are very low now at the moment, but they are still there. In the Federal Reserve System, it varies quite a lot depending on the amount of deposits. It varies from 5% to 10% actually, still nowadays. But in the ECB system from 2012, I think it was at that time. Before that, it was from the launch of the ECB system, it was approximately 2%, but after that, it has been only 1%. Because it has more or less, as a monetary policy tool, it has more or less lost its significance during the unconventional monetary policy actions. Nevertheless, so let's start now the discussion about this. So the amount of, let's denote the First National Bank as Bank A. So the things that first happened there was that its amount of reserves increased by 100 and its amount of checkable deposits or liabilities increased also by 100. So if we assume that from the increase of 100 of the deposits, you have to deposit a 10% deposit to the central bank account as a banker to meet the reserve requirement ratio. Reserve requirement ratio is 10%. So in decimal figures, it's 0.1. So basically, your amount of checkable deposits is still the 100 million dollars, but the amount of required reserves, all the reserves are now in the form of required reserves. In this case, if you want to expand your loan portfolio for the rest of the reserves. So the original change in the reserves is being used to the extension of your loan portfolio for 90, worth 90, because you have to have required reserves in the central bank for 10. Once again, it's obviously possible that all the loans that are being taken from, let's say, OP can be deposited to Nordea. No one is denying that. It's a possibility that all the funding can go to the other bank also. So let's assume in this case that there is a change in the balance sheet of the Nordea. So there, the reserves now increase. The originator of the monetary expansion process was the central bank. It wanted to go into actions with OP Group, but the customers want to move the money that the OP Group has been giving or the funds in the form of loans to Nordea. So Nordea faces a situation that even though it has nothing to do at the origin with the central bank, it's beneficial for that also, that the OP has been doing things with the central bank. So the amount of reserves in Nordea balance sheet increases for the amount of loans given from OP, so 90, and the amount of checkable deposits also increases by 90. The same reserve requirement ratio applies for Nordea. Let's assume that it's 10%, even though it's in reality it's only 1%. The ECB level, but for the purposes of giving a more clear example, let's assume that it's still 10%. So Nordea is now also able to expand its loan portfolio. So it engaged into this multiple deposit creation process through the expansion of loan portfolio. An originator is the central bank action with the OP. And then this starts to evolve through the whole banking system. So it's a multiple effect on the amount of deposits, even though the originator is the activity of worth of 100 million only between central bank and the OP. Okay, so at the final stages, when we go through all the possibilities, let's assume that all the banks are not willing to have any idle reserves. They just want to meet the reserve requirement and loan, give loans for the rest of the reserves that they are able to receive from the customers from other banks that are depositing money to their accounts. So total for the whole system, assuming these original things for the amount of 100 million dollars between OP and central bank, if you assume a 10% required reserve ratio, then at the end of the day, when all these expansionary processes have gone through, the effect at the aggregate level is 1,000 million. So it's 10 times the original amount. So this 10 is called the deposit multiplier. And it's just based on the reserve ratio, the required reserves ratio. How much an assumption that the banks are always willing to give the extra reserves after the required reserves as a loans. But what is the problem now? Why does this process not seem to work? As you see, it should have a clearly huge expansionary effect on the overall real economic activity, because at all these stages from ABC and onwards, there are possibilities to increase real consumption for the amounts of these deposits, basically, at the maximum. So what is now the problem? Why does not this work at the moment? Yeah.
I'm just guessing that do the banks need more reserves?
Yeah, exactly. You guessed right. The banks are keeping extra reserves in addition to the reserve requirement ratio. So they are not willing to give the loans to the customers, even though the central bank is doing this expansionary monetary policy actions. Banks want to, they prefer investing to other banks' assets or government assets or any other forms than loans. This is a harsh simplification, but that is actually the grounding reason for not having these real economic activity increases based on huge amounts of expansionary monetary policy actions at the shorter end of the maturity structure, already before corona crisis, for example. So this is the, I think this is actually quite simple idea, but in reality, it's the thing that should be going on. It's the way how the central bank can increase real economic activity through this banking system, through the increases in the deposits that are enabling the agents, firms, and households to consume more because the amount of deposits or the money is increasing in the economy so much. So when we want to derive the formula for multiple deposit creation, I will give these formulas, the main important formulas from whole of the courses, themes to you at the end of the course before the exams. So you can use those, even though you can use all the material during taking the exam, it might be actually very useful for you to get the very quick look at the equations. I'm giving you a set of equations, but you first have to understand what are the equations. I don't give all the explanations for the denotations or the notations, but I will give you the equations. So, assuming banks do not hold excess reserves, this does not hold at the moment. They are holding very much excess reserves. Then required reserves equals total reserves, and RR is the required reserve ratio. Small case r times the total amount of checkable deposits. So it's always dependent on the amount of deposits. How much you have to have required reserves is always dependent on the amount of deposits. When we substitute this r times d to the upper equals uppercase r and divide both sides by the reserve requirement ratio, so lowercase r, we get the amount of deposit to be dependent on the reserves, total reserves, and the reserve ratio, required reserve ratio. If we want to analyze this as a dynamic equation, then we analyze the changes in these guys, and it's holding at each and every point of time. The only thing that changes here is the amount of reserves and the deposits. This is being assumed to be constant throughout time, so the required reserve ratio is not changing. So basically we can get the equation for the changes in deposits. It's completely dependent on the changes in the reserves. The only thing that has an effect is the percentage share that has to be deposited to the central bank in the form of required reserves. Okay. There's obviously lots of criticism for this model. This seems to be something that it's not holding, especially currently, because the banks are basically holding cash or other forms of most liquid assets in their balance sheets at the moment. And the problem is that holding cash has no multiple deposit expansion, actually. So it's just cash. You can use that for own purposes, but not for the purposes of others. That's the reason for why not currencies is not having this same effect. So banks may not use all of their excess reserves to buy securities or make loans, and depositors' decisions how much to hold cash and banks' decisions amount of excess reserves also cause the money supply to change. And now it is a perverse situation. It seems to be the case that the general public is willing to hold lots of cash, but not consume very much. And the banking sector is willing to hold many other forms of most liquid assets, more preferably than engaging into the loan expansion process and deposit expansion process. So this is not working in simple terms. This is not working at the moment. But in normal times, it should be the thing that first sort of starts to work when the central bank wants to engage into monetary policy actions. Okay, so factors, let's take a recap once again. Factors that determine the money supply. First of all, changes in the non-borrowed monetary base. Money supply is positively related to the non-borrowed monetary base. If you want to take a derivative of the derivative of the overall money supply, then the partial derivative regarding the non-borrowed monetary base is positive. Then changes in borrowed reserves from the central bank. Once again, the partial derivative regarding that is also positive. So the money supply is positively related to the level of borrowed reserves. This comes from the simple ideas that we discussed. Then, if we take a list of the most important factors that determine the money supply, first of all, there's this change in the required reserves ratio. Nowadays, in the ECB level, it doesn't play actually very much a role. But in the Federal Reserve system before Corona, it actually had something to do, but it has lost its significance also in the Federal Reserve after the Corona. It's not playing a big role anymore there. And then changes in currency holdings. Money supply is negatively related to currency holdings and changes in excess reserves. Money supply is negatively related to the amount of excess reserves. Excess reserves are the residual of the reserves after you have deposited the required reserves to the central bank. Excess reserves are the ones that you can give as a loan to other agents in the economy. Okay, so here's a list of these variables that have an effect on the money supply, amount of money supply, non-borrowed monetary policy base has a positive effect, required reserve ratio has a negative effect on borrowed reserves. So we are just discussing about the positive changes in these variables. How do they affect on the money supply? So if borrowed reserves increase, it increases money supply. And if excess reserves increase, it decreases the money supply because the deposit creation process gets to be stopped or hindered, at least slowed. And currency holdings also have a negative effect on the money supply. All these things you should be able to discuss based on the simple definition for the monetary base and money supply. Remember these components that constitute the monetary base. All right. So in macroeconomic aggregate level models, the effects of money supply have been usually discussed based on this idea of money multiplier. So it links the money supply measure to the monetary base. Monetary base is the thing that the central bank is able to almost completely dictate. Close to 100% of that. Monetary base is the thing. And so let's denote lowercase m to refer to the money multiplier. So if we want to derive that, we have to take into account the possible changes or different values for the currency ratio. How much do the general public and banks also want to hold in the form of currency? How much do they want to give as a loans to the customers from the reserves? So that refers to the excess reserves ratio. So assume that the desired holdings of currency are C and excess reserves ER grow proportionally with check capital deposits. So they are in a constant relation to the amount of the check capital deposits. Obviously, this relationship actually varies through time. But to get the, let's say, static interpretation of the role of these things at certain levels or certain values for those things, you have to start from that. But obviously, one of the interesting things actually to be analyzed, you can actually do your thesis, very nice thesis would be about the discussion of the development over time of the currency ratio and excess reserves ratio in the banking system during the unconventional monetary policy actions. And actually about these things, you could get an idea from that joint banking and finance paper that I will be giving to you as one of the papers for the home assignments. So we are using lots of definitions for these things, but they add up to something together. So the total amount of reserves is down to be R. It equals the sum of required reserves and excess reserves. From the excess reserves, the bank can give you loans. So R equals RR plus ER. Total amount of required reserves equals the required reserve ratio times the amount of check capital deposits. So the required reserves, so the ones deposited to the central bank by the banks, are dependent on the central bank dictated required reserve ratio and the amount of deposit. So this is the actual amount. How much do you have to deposit to an account in the central bank as a banker? Substituting for RR in this first equation, so substitute this guy here, you get the notion for the reserves. Reserves are equal to the required reserve ratio times the deposits plus excess reserves. So usually the central banks obviously set this R to be lower than one. They don't want to have, it would be ridiculous to have this very high. If the origins or the idea, original idea of doing monetary policy expansions is to enable the banking sector to give more loans, it can only give more loans from the excess reserves. So these are usually very, very low. But in the Federal Reserve, this has actually, this R, lowercase r, required reserve ratio, has played a role before Corona, still before Corona, but not in the ECB. And the main reason for that is that we have had these negative interest rates for a long period of time. So required reserves have been paid a negative interest rate at the ECB system for a long period of time already. So it's already a penalty for the banks because it's costly for them to deposit to the central banks. So there's no meaning for increasing R because it's already for small amounts of required reserves. It's costly for them. So it would be a double worry or double, let's say, nuisance for the banking sector to increase also the quota ratio and pay lower interest rate, negative interest rate for that. So the costs would clearly double. And the idea is that the banks should be giving more loans, so they should not be holding excess reserves. And the idea is that they should be giving more loans to the other participants in the economy. So the monetary base, MB equals currency, C plus reserves R. And this equation reveals you the amount of the monetary base needed to support the existing amount of checkable deposits, first of all, and then currency and excess reserves. So at the final stages, when going through all these replacements in the denotions, denote first the currency multiplier as the amount of currency divided by the amount of deposits. So that gives you the amount of currency to be in relation to the deposits based on the currency multiplier. And so obviously this also is always below one, because it would be one when all the deposits are held in the form of currency, obviously. Excess reserves are the residual from the reserves. So basically, you can also denote that they should be in connection to the deposits. So excess reserves plus currency are together the amount of deposits. Substituting in the previous equation, you get the monetary base. And now you are able to combine all these animals here because you have a common factor as a D, the deposits, amount of deposits. So R plus E plus C times D equals the monetary base. When you divide both sides by the term in here as the multiplier of the deposits, then you get the amount of deposits to be inversely related to these individual multipliers from currency, excess reserves, and required reserves. So remembering that the money supply equals deposits plus currency, and currency equals currency multiplier times deposits, and so you can replace there, and you are able to find the relationship between the monetary base and money supply that takes into account now the willingness of banks to have excess reserves also, and the willingness of general public to hold currency also, and also the required reserve ratio. That is something that is dictated by the central bank. So the only animal here, or only part of the component, in many cases I use the word of animal when it's somehow blurry thing, but it's here actually. But here, the only thing that the central bank can actually dictate completely is this lowercase r, required reserve ratio. All these other things basically are dependent on the preferences of the banking sector and also the general public. So these are actually very uncertain and stochastic things for the central bank. It can only estimate those based on the historical data, that what had they been in the past. How much have the people been willing to hold in the form of currency? How much have the banking sector been willing to hold excess reserves to expand their loan portfolios? It only can have an idea about those. It cannot dictate those because they are based on the other agents' preferences. The only part here that the central bank has a complete power to control is the lowercase r, required reserve ratio. But all these other guys actually have a similar kind of effect on the money multiplier, as does the required reserve ratio, basically. But the effect of a currency multiplier is actually kind of a non-linear. So the overall effect depends on the size of the currency multiplier quite a lot, actually. How much do the general public want to have in the form of currency? Holding currency is not good. Holding currency at your hands for the economy is basically not good in the longer terms if you have it too much, because it hinders the possibility to give more loans based on the deposits. So it's actually, this is a, let's say, double-edged sword, basically, because holding currency enables consumption more at the moment, but it doesn't enable giving loans to increase the consumption in the future and investments, for example, of the firms. So it's a double-edged sword in one sense. But nevertheless, central bank can try, and it always tries to estimate what is the level of money supply in actual terms based on these things. It always forms some estimates for the current currency multiplier, excess ratio or excess reserve multiplier, and also it has complete power over the required reserve ratio. Okay, so as an example, just plug in these example numbers to this equation so you can get for a required reserve ratio of 1.10% and the currency in circulation is $400 billion at a certain point of time and amount of checkable deposits 800 and excess reserves is almost 1 billion and money supply is equals the amount of currency plus deposits, so you get the sum of those to be 1,200 billion. Currency multiplier equals 400 divided by 800 is 0.5, and excess reserves multiplier equals 0.8 divided by 800, so it's 0.001, so it's very low. So in overall terms, you can calculate the size of the money multiplier. It's 2.5. So if the monetary base increases by 1 percentage point, it has a 2.5 percentage point effect on the money supply. Using these parameters for the relevant things that have an effect on that. Obviously, in some other point of time, these can be clearly different. But the main thing is that how much do these lowercase r and c and e change? They are the things that are changing actually over time quite a lot. So this is clearly less than the simple deposit multiplier because we are not engaging in this deposit expansion process at all here. So obviously it's lower. This is about how much does the very short-term money supply increase when the monetary base is changed. Monetary base is the one that the central bank can have full control over. And there are lots of other things than just the required reserve ratio that have the role to play in terms of the overall effect of the changes in the monetary base regarding the money supply. Because it has to take into account that the other agents in the economy have their own preferences. The general public has a preference for holding currency. How much do they want to have that in relation to deposits? And the banking sector has a preference for using excess reserves. And the problem is now at the moment that the amount of excess reserves is huge at the moment. And they are not being used in the loan expansion process at all. And one of the reasons is that central bank has been buying, to my mind, a bit wrong type of assets for a long period because they have been buying the government assets. But they have been willing to save the banking sector in this form. Jari Mikko will be discussing about the role of supervision and regulator in this context, especially regarding the requirements for the liquidity ratio. How much do the banks are the banks supposed to have extra liquidity to meet the liquidity needs that come from the Basel III agreement? Because after the 2008 crisis, we actually had a situation that some of the banks that were well, had a very good capital structure, they were performing well in that sense, still faced the problems with the liquidity. So they were not able to meet the general public's requirements for withdrawal deposits at some points, and it caused a bankruptcy for some of the banks. So that actually gave the main reason for increasing the liquidity requirements for the banking sector through the Basel Agreement. Okay, so quantitative easing and the money supply process. When the global financial crisis began in 2007, the Federal Reserve started these lending programs and large-scale asset purchase programs, and just before the crisis, recent crisis, these purchases of securities had led to a quantitative of the federal, so 5 times higher than before that, before starting of the global crisis on the federal balance sheet, and a 350% increase in the monetary base. So there is a huge amount of liquidity in the system currently. And these programs actually resulted in a huge expansion of the monetary base, and they have been given this name of quantitative easing. And it didn't lead to this expansion of the real economy. And that is the problem. And the reason is just that the banks want to have these excess reserves in the form of liquid assets. And it's a problem. They don't want to engage in this long expansion process and deposit creation process very much. And here is an example about the development of the M1, which is the most narrow definition for the money supply. So it takes into account the checkable accounts, for example, and that relationship regarding the development of the monetary base. So you see that in terms of the connections between the monetary base and M1, they are clearly positively connected to each other in longer terms. They have been in that connection since 2007. And the excess reserves, development and excess reserves was a clear problem. And currency ratio has also had a role to play, but it has decreased. So that is actually not so big problem. But the excess reserves ratio was the main problem that hindered the survival of the real economic activity in terms of what are the effects of these monetary policy actions. Okay, so basically, the next step would be the discussion about more detailed discussion about the tools and conduct of the monetary policy actions, but let's start. It's a clearly bigger theme, so let's start from that one. The week after next week, because Dennis is going to be giving the lectures next week, and as I already told you, we have decided that Dennis is willing to give the lectures from Vaasa, so it's only online. And probably based on my experiences in the performance of the IT equipment in these classrooms here in Agora and Mattilaniemi, I'm very much also thinking that I might be moving to completely online performance. But if there's any one of you that want to have this in class, prefer to have these in-class lectures, then send me an email. But if it's okay to you, so that in order to avoid further confusion regarding the equipment, because I have been forced to change the position for two times already now, and already in this morning also we had a problem with the PC. So probably I will be giving all the lectures through only Zoom from the week after Dennis has visited us. But Jari Mikko was willing to still give you the in-class lectures. And I have to check from Olli-Pekka Ruuskanen whether he's willing to give an online sessions only. He will be here on the 16th of October or from Helsinki. Okay. So that was that. See you next week. I will be also participating to the sessions given by Dennis, because we have to decide together where to save the Zoom lectures. So we will be seeing you next Wednesday. Okay.